The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
From the 37 verses of the practice of a bodhisattva. Once you become accustomed to the karmic afflictions, they're hard to cure with antidotes. Therefore, with the remedies of mindfulness and alertness to eliminate afflictions the moment they arise is the practice of a bodhisattva. In brief, wherever you are and whatever you do, always examine the state of your mind, cultivating mindfulness and awareness continuously to benefit others is the practice of a bodhisattva. It's kind of like having gone through this whole journey of the bodhisattva practices, we end up back on our cushion. We end up within our mind. In brief, means this is what it all comes down to. Means don't forget this. Wherever you are, whatever you do, examine the state of your mind. And perhaps we can say that this is really what distinguishes, characterizes Buddhist practice and meditation. Just this. Thubten Chodron on this fascicle, on this verse, said, to sum up the previous 35 verses, whatever you're doing, whether you're standing, lying down, walking or sitting, whether you're awake or asleep, whether you're happy or miserable, whether people like you or don't like you, whether you're dying or living, whether you're in pain or healthy, no matter what's going on in your life, ask yourself, what is the state of my mind? Where is my mind now? Because the mind is a source of happiness and suffering, it's important to check what state it's in. She goes on to say, then, being aware of the state, examine, is my mind involved in what is constructive and virtuous now? Or have the thieves of disturbing emotions taken over and are they running the show? Who's in charge here? And then she says, we do this no matter what's going on in our lives. We don't have to sit in a meditation hall. We don't have to be healthy. We don't have to be seated in the meditation posture in order to do this. Whatever we're doing, whatever is happening, we practice. We keep integrating our mind with bodhicitta, no matter what situation we find ourselves in. It's a very clear presentation of what it is we're really aspiring to do, endeavoring to do, practicing. In a sense, this is an expression of the deep faith in Buddha Dharma, that no matter what's happening, that's just what's happening in this moment. That's going to change. It will come and go. But what is the constant? What do we keep coming back to? What is our refuge? In samsara, we try to find refuge in all of those different states. And so we try and get as many good ones as we can and avoid as many of the bad ones as we can. And so it's a little bit like going through an arcade, you know, which is an endless avenue of vendors. And going towards the one, I want to buy something here. No, that doesn't interest me. In a sense, what she's saying is, know what your life is about. I think of Dada Roshi saying so many times, take responsibility. This is what it means. It's my mind. It's my present moment. It's my state. It's my suffering. It's my happiness. Whatever is going on, those things remain the same. How we bring the path into our lives, this right now. How we bring this right now into the path. Whatever appears in your mind is Dharma practice. Dharma practice is whatever appears in your mind. The student asked Master Xiaozhou, during the 24 hours, how is the mind put to use? And Xiaozhou said, you are used by the 24 hours. I use the 24 hours. Which of these times are you talking about? You know, one of the, as we practice and sort of are introduced in a very sort of direct and persistent way to the idea of dualities, we encounter the duality of what is practice and what's not. What is practice and what's everything else? When are those moments when I examine, I practice mindfulness, I see the Dharma, and then what are all the moments where that's just not what's happening? Not even so much because we forget, but because we just say, well, that's just not what that's about. That great divide. Little wonder that it's so hard to merge that, to even have faith in that. Because we have so many actual moments of experience where this moment, what's happening right now, just doesn't seem, oh, what the hell could this have to do with the Dharma or liberation or the teachings or... So Zazen is really a demonstration of that. So what does that look like, we might ask? No matter what's going on in my life. And somebody from the wing says, Zazen. That's what it looks like. Using the 24 hours of the day, not to produce results, not to get ahead, not to make a profit. But just to, within every moment, standing, lying down, sitting, walking, whether you're awake or asleep, whether you're happy or miserable, whether people like you or don't like you, right? So all of those things have been happening during the week, right? At least, perhaps within your mind. Whether you're in pain or healthy, no matter what's going on. And this question, what is the state of my mind, is not just a question. It's a practice. It's a way of seeing. It's like, take heed, do not squander your life. And because our minds, you know, it sees things as different, and then it puts things into categories, right? So that we can kind of keep things organized. So there's the animal world, the plant world, the work world, the relationship world, the physical world, the emotional world. All these various categories. And so why wouldn't we do that to Zazen and to practice? So we can reduce Zazen to just don't be distracted or just pay attention. And so the Buddha made very clear that right mindfulness had very particular aspects. I spoke about the other day. We could reduce concentration or samadhi to kind of a rigid state of concentration or a kind of blind or blank state of focus. And so the Buddha taught right concentration to make it very clear that within that there needs to be skillfulness, there needs to be right effort, there needs to be, as I spoke about the other day, what is translated as compunction, the ability, sort of our moral life, our moral compass, recognizing what's good and what's not, what's helpful and what's not, our aspiration, all of those things, working together. Cultivating mindfulness and awareness continuously. And that's daunting, right? That's a daunting prospect, continuously. In the meeting I had this morning with a group of students, we're talking about just the ango and the study of these verses and the bodhisattva practice and path. And somebody brought up the notion of a failing, you know, a falling short. And, you know, I mentioned that during the ongo intensive that came up and somebody, and I brought it up, and, you know, in terms of failing, and somebody, I don't remember exactly, but I'll just say this because this is the point I want to make, is is that, and because it often does come up, is because failure is so painful. And there's been so much, in many of our lives, there's so much punishing and punishment around failure. And so it seems like something we don't want to continue to sort of cultivate the idea of, you know, and the punishment that comes around that. But I purposefully brought it up, and somebody questioned that, and I said, well, look, you know, if I continue to experience things that I'm doing such that when things don't work out or something just falls through, falls apart, and I experience that as failure, then I need to learn how to deal with that, right? If that's sort of that, so that's my conventional truth. That's my reality. I'm experiencing that as failure. And something didn't work out, right? And we can say, well, but that's, you know, that's going to evolve into something else, which maybe will be successful. I mean, we can do all kinds of framing, which might be true, but it also might just be trying to make me feel good and take away the sting. And so to actually acknowledge, yeah, I really put my heart into this and it didn't work out. Or I tried out for this and I didn't get selected, you know. So I tried out for, you know, positions when I was a musician or, you know, and wasn't selected, right? I wanted that, and I didn't get it. And so if I experience that as a kind of failure of something that I wanted, then how do I hold that? Can I hold that in a different way that isn't punishing? But it's just acknowledging, yeah, I really tried. I did all that I could, and I didn't get it. And can I make my peace with that? And so the notion of bringing that into this great vow, the bodhisattva vow, you know, and I said, can you imagine that there was a single person going all the way back who took up the bodhisattva vow in earnest and did not fall short? In other words, can you imagine that there was somebody who just took it up and perfectly embodied the bodhisattva practice in every moment? I mean, maybe. You know. And I said, maybe our great aspiration needs to and is intended to hold and be in part of that aspiration is our falling short. Not just as inspiration, but falling. Can we be liberated there? Can we, when that is the state, when that is what's happening, no matter what's going on, when that's what's happening, can I see into that? Can I see into my mind? Can I free myself within that falling? In other words, we kind of have to get used to it, right? Because to have an aspiration means there's something I want to do, right? There's something that I'm investing in. I'm sort of saying, this is what I'm going to do. You know, when we take vows, they're not like, you know, they're not loaded with like exits. It's a vow. It's a very declarative statement. It's, I vow to this. This is my vow. That's why they're scary, right? That's why we don't rush into taking vows here. And because we should know that in taking that vow and mean it, to mean it means I am not always going to live up to it. In fact, it may at times seem like I'm more not living up to it than I am. And to find encouragement in that, to find honesty in that, to find humanity in that, to find company in that. Good company, actually. Some of the best. Cultivating mindfulness and awareness continuously to examine our mind, it means to know our mind, to know your mind, your body, your sensations, your emotions, your thoughts, your concerns, your moods. The world we grow up in, unless we grow up in a very fortunate, perhaps unusual way, you know, is constantly telling us about all kinds of things outside. How to navigate and negotiate that, but very little about the inner landscape. Robert Thurman speaks of the inner astronaut. Wherever you are, whatever you do, always examine the mind. Always see. Always be paying attention. Within your mindfulness, empowered by your mindfulness, see into more clearly. See what obstructs you from seeing clearly and attend to that. The more we pay attention, the more we see what we need to pay attention to. The more we see what makes it difficult for us to do exactly this, the more we're learning where we need to apply our effort. How to use the 24 hours of the day. A student asked Master Xiaozhou, where can I be of service? And Xiaozhou said, where can you not be of service? Dogen wrote two fascicles, two parts, to very long joined fascicle and continuous practice. In the beginning, I wanted to read from this because it's quite beautiful and it really, I think, ties in with this very nicely. You know, to examine the mind, Bodhidharma spoke of beholding the mind. I believe he's saying the same thing. There are many ways it's expressed. A student asked Master Matsu, what is Buddha? And Matsu said, mind is Buddha. He's not talking about examining the mind. He's talking about what we realize when we examine the mind. Dogen said it this way: on the great road of Buddha ancestors, there is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained, wherever you are, whatever's happening. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. This being so, continuous practice is undivided. It's not forced by you or by others. The power of this continuous practice confirms you as well as others. It means your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. Although not noticed by others or by yourself, this is so. This endless circle of the way, infinite, complete, including all with no gaps. And this is not the circle of samsara, the spinning, the coming back around again. This is a path that is complete from the beginning. That is, wherever you arrive into this circle, wherever you begin, the whole of it's there. The circle of the way. All, not only is all of the Dharma there, but all of your ancestors are there. The Buddha and all of the teachers, all of the practitioners. You know, we only hear about a handful of teachers, really. Thousands, 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 not just teachers, people, practitioners. All ages, all types, all stripes. Throughout all of these ages. The fact is, we can practice or not practice, but this circle of the way is never cut off. We can turn away from the Dharma, but the Dharma is never apart from where we are. You know, so turning away is just another kind of thing we're doing in our mind. It's like water trying to divorce wetness. And that's a really beautiful thing, you know, because we can, within ourselves, quite decisively turn away, walk away, stop, give it up for a day, for a year, for 10 years, 20 years. And in the one moment where the thought appears again, it's there. I think I was talking the other day about, you know, thinking of the Dharma as that which, you know, understands and sees into and accepts all of our person, all of our humanity, all of the good and all of the hidden things, right? Without any condition, without any provision, without any time limit, no matter what, right? How often have we encountered such a thing? And we could say the same thing here, that we can, you know, it's like a friend that you can stop calling and think badly about and want to burn down their house and, you know, say all kinds of bad things about them, write nasty letters, move 1,000 miles away. And the moment when you turn back to them, they're there and they say, oh, I never stopped loving you. If the Dharma could talk. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there's not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. This being so, continuous practice is undivided. It's not forced by you or others. And so that's really what we practice in Sishin, isn't it? From the moment we wake up. Continuous, right? And so we enter into silence to make that easier, more facile, more clear as to when that's present and when it's not. And all throughout the day, from one moment of practice to the next, that's the continuous thread. To merge all aspects of the day into one whole quilt of mindfulness, of seeing, of examination, of compassion. And as we continue on the path, in the beginning, it must be deliberate. It has to be. Right? Because the habit of forgetting is so strong that it's not even a matter of forgetting. It's hard to even know in the beginning, in the first place, to be able to forget. And so it has to be deliberate. And so we have to use ways of helping us to point to and lay out, okay, this is the time to remember. This is the beginning of something. And so we have instruments which not only call us together, but are also telling us something is getting ready to happen. We do prostrations. We have ways that we move our body and our mind and our voice, some of them ritualized, right? So that we can bring this sort of habit of forgetting into a practice of remembering. And to recognize how powerful these rituals are. I was thinking of when I was in grade school and high school, I played sports. And in football, when I was playing football, there was in other sports, but particularly during football, because you know, when you're playing football, you know, you're kind of throwing your body around and like dragging people down to the ground and knocking your head into them. You know, it's contact. And so it's hard not to get hurt. And it's easy to get pissed off because you're getting hurt. And so there's all of this going on, and it's a game, right? And at the end, somebody wins and somebody loses. And then there's a ritual where both teams come together and sort of walk past each other. Good game, good game, good game, good game. Right, that's the ritual. And sometimes it's like, man. Right? Because you're not happy about this. Right? But the ritual demands that you do that. You walk those steps, you pass these people that a moment ago you were trying to drag down, right? And now you're looking at them and you're speaking. It is undivided. It is not forced by ourselves or by others. How important is this? Within our effort, our perseverance, our forbearance, our resilience, all of these are necessary. But none of them are a matter of force. And that's a real challenge. None of them are an expression of aggression, intended to be. None of them are about being in conflict. We are not applying ourselves because there is a conflict at heart. We're trying to end the conflict, the sense of a conflict. We're trying to calm this aggression. We're trying to discover new ways, create new pathways. But force and aggression and conflict are the models and examples that we have been so trained in, whether literally, like through sports, for instance. Growing up, that was very much part of it. You know, our coach is not saying, now boys, go out there and love your enemy. No. Go out and kick their ass. Bring them down. Get angry. So finding new ways, because we, to whatever degree we might have been taught this, but we see it on display, that life is a battleground. You either live or die, you win or you lose, which side are you going to be on? It's the model of domination and control and patriarchy that can only breed, has to breed, fear and anxiety and suspicion and distrust and enmity. Has to. That's its food. And so to enter into this practice and meet things that appear like the enemy, things that appear to be aggressing upon us, that appear to be creating conflict within us, it's very hard not to respond in that way. Which is why it's so important to do this. And in this, Dogen says, the power of this continuous practice confirms you. It confirms you, as well as other, confirms all that you are. More than you even ever imagined or allowed yourself to consider. Moreover, it means your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. You may not notice this. Others may not notice this, but this is so. The more we practice, the more we see. Buddha nature pervades the whole universe, existing here, now, in you, in me, in this thing that is happening. And in that, it is confirmed. It is affirmed. And that doesn't mean it is confirmed as necessarily good or right or skillful, but it is confirmed. It is seen. When Mara would come to the Buddha and try to knock him off his seat or distract him or get in his way, the Buddha would look and say, I know you. And at that moment, Mara had no more power. So since, how much are we working towards just that? I know you. The you being you. And knowing you, then we find it naturally easier and easier to know others. And whether we know it or not, this is so. Dogen says, accordingly, by the continuous practice of all Buddhas and ancestors, your practice is actualized and your great road opens up. By your continuous practice, the practice of all Buddhas is actualized and the great road of all Buddhas is opened up. This is the circle of the way. By this practice, Buddha ancestors abide as Buddha. They also non-abide as Buddha. They have Buddha mind, and they attain Buddha without cutting anything off. This is what's been handed down, person to person. And you know, really think about that. That within monasteries and sutras and history and scholarship and legends and all the rest, this thing that we call Buddhism, Buddha Dharma, this thing that we practice, has been handed down from person to person. That's how it's handed. That's how it's conveyed. Person to person, teacher to student, Buddha to Buddha, and all the while, it can't be given to you. Rather, you uncover it in your very body and mind, in your clear awareness and understanding through continuous practice. You show up in Zazen and you drop away in zazen. You practice the sense of self arising and you forget the sense of self. Your practice is actualized and your great road opens up. A life that is, we now see, was quite small. Has now become quite large, unimaginably large. What you have trusted, what we have studied, what we practice, all step by step, year by year, is being actualized, made real, known to you in all different kinds of ways. And your road, the whole world, opens up like a flower. Dogen says, because of this practice, there's the sun, the moon, and stars. Because of this practice, there's the great earth and the open sky. There's your body and mind and your environment. There are the four great elements and the five skandhas. Because of this practice, all of these things appear. Emptiness is form. And then he says, continuous practice is not necessarily something people in the world love, but it should be the true place of return for everyone. Because of this, all the Buddhas of the past, present, and future are actualized. This is not necessarily something that people in the world love. Yep. But it should be the true place of return. It's not necessary to love it. It's helpful, but it's not necessary. Sometimes not loving it can be extremely helpful, actually. How do you open up your road then, when that's what's happening? How do you examine your mind from within? When you feel like you are outside and can't find your way in, or maybe don't want to find your way in, how do you look at that from within, from inside? That's magic. It's not necessary to love life in every moment, to love the Dharma every day, to love Zazen. For those studying koans, you definitely know the experience of not loving a koan. You'd like to bite its little head off because it seems to be making you very unhappy. Because it's a road that is not yet opening up. How does that road open up? From the inside. How do you find your way in when you seem to be out? It can only happen because you're in. You're not out. Facing what is true should not be built upon an emotion which comes and goes. Emotions, I spoke about the other day, are so powerful. And when they're in alignment, or when we're using them, when we're learning how to use them, then they become even more powerful. And they can be greatly inspiring and motivational. But they're not always present. Great aspiration is just that, it's aspiration. Practice is just that, it's practice. At all times, whatever's happening. And so when things seem to be aligning and we feel everything coming together, very good. When everything seems to be turning against you, very well. It's easy to talk about these things. to say those words. You know, I remember sitting in this zendo in the early years, being so inspired when Dada Roshi would talk about this, and I just thought, yes, I'm ready. And then when it happened, I wasn't ready. I certainly didn't feel ready. I wanted what he was talking about. I didn't want this. And more often than not, I didn't even make a connection. It wasn't like, oh, this is what he was talking about. It's like, no, this is just bullshit. It's just in my way. I'm trying to get back to what he was talking about. And that's why aspiration is such a profoundly spiritual matter, which means you just can't figure it all out. It's just not all going to add up. There's a leaping that has to take place. There's a deep trust that has to take place that you may not even know where is that coming from. When I think back about this deep feeling of affinity that I had when I first encountered the Dharma and this trust that I felt right away, I don't know. I don't remember whether I really questioned that. Like, what's that about? What are you doing, man? Maybe I did. I don't really remember. I mean, I definitely remember having moments of doubt when I was practicing. But just that faith, I don't know. It just felt like, oh, okay, this is true. How do I know that? I have no idea. And because it's so deep in that way, it doesn't have to rely on suffering alone, which can be a profound motivation, but it's not the only motivation. It needs to not be the only motivation. And it doesn't have to be diminished by comfort. Whatever is happening. Dogen says, the effect of such sustained practice is sometimes not hidden. Therefore, you aspire to practice. The effect is sometimes not apparent. And therefore, you may not see or hear or know it. But understand that although it is not revealed, it is not hidden. This is so important. Sometimes it is not hidden. And those are moments that we really enjoy. We appreciate that, right? And it's good. It's good to find that confirmation, to experience that encouragement. Practice and verify. But we must not be dependent upon that. Because if we are, then we will be very inconsistent. The effect sometimes is not apparent. You may not see or hear or know it, but understand that although it is not revealed, it is never hidden. Which means it is not hidden. I just don't see it. That's all. I don't see it yet. I temporarily do not see it. It's easy to be inspired when we see the effects, but can we trust our practice when we don't? I mean, that's what it comes down to. And so we make vows, we make commitments. I am going to do this. That's what's so powerful, so mad about commitments. Such a unique, seemingly a unique human thing. We leap into a present which contains within it our future, and we don't know what's going to happen. And it's not just like, well, you know, I'll see, I'll keep one foot in, one foot out. It's like, I'm in. I'm doing this. Where's it going? I don't know. How are you going to handle it? I don't know. But what do you know within that commitment? you know what you need to do in each moment. I was telling somebody earlier, you know, sitting in the Zendo and having moments. I remember one particular moment where I thought, okay, I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm really seriously thinking. I don't think I can do this. And I started to sort of survey my options. And I realized there are lots of things I could do, but for me, none of those were options. Because I thought, what's actually going to change? Nothing. My environment, little else. I'm not going to change. I'm still me. And what's happening right now, that's coming with me. It's just going to happen in a different environment. That was very helpful. Vimalakirti talks about the Buddha field, which is this field of continuous practice. And in the sutra, the Buddha says, a Buddha field is of bodhisattvas is a field of living beings. Why? Because a bodhisattva embraces a Buddha field, your environment, your body and mind, the place where you are, to the same extent that they cause the development of living beings. They embrace a Buddha field to the same extent that living beings become disciplined, wake up to their moral aliveness, to the same extent that through entrance into a Buddha field, they're introduced to Buddha wisdom. That through entering into this Buddha field, living beings increase their virtuous qualities. A Buddha field of bodhisattvas springs from the aims of living beings, our aspirations. For example, he says, should you wish to build an empty space, one might go ahead in spite of the fact that you can't do that. It's not possible to build or to adorn anything in empty space. But you go ahead and do that. You build a Buddha field in empty space. In the same way, a bodhisattva who knows full well that all things are like empty space wishes to build a Buddha field in order to develop themselves and living beings, in spite of the fact that this isn't actually possible. It's not utterly existing. And so we trust our mind and our words and our actions and our invocations, our giving and taking, our four immeasurables, our visualizations, because that's creating a field in empty space that is extremely powerful and skillful. And so whether we see the results of our actions or not is not actually that important. Dogen says, you may not notice the causal conditions which brought you here. The reason you don't see it is that in becoming conscious of it, this is not anything remarkable. So we can each think of the causal conditions that brought us here, and we might think of moments, conversations, events in our life that sort of opened our eyes, began us thinking. But the conditions that brought us here are not reducible to one or two or three things. We may not understand them, but they have brought us here. We have brought ourselves here. The wonder of that. The improbability of that. Right? I had a plan in my life. It wasn't here. I was on a route. I was on a trajectory. Boom. Straight ahead. And then here I am. And Dogen says, not remarkable. Why? Because it's the reality before our eyes, because Buddha nature is your nature. It's nothing special. It's already present in you. That's true for everybody. It's not unique. Practice and realization is ultimately not of your own doing. Nothing to be proud of. The wonder of this. Because it is not remarkable, it is wondrous. Investigate in detail that this is so, because the causal conditions, that is your aspiration, is no other than your practice. And through your practice, it is not limited by any causal condition. Dada Roshi said it this way, all the way to heaven is heaven. I wanted to mention that tomorrow, because we will not be doing Dharma Encounter, we'll do a mando. Doing Dharma Encounter, usually we'd put up the koan that the student is working on and everyone would have a chance to sort of stew in it a little bit to get ready. So I'd like to do this. Tomorrow in the mando, to end the ango, I'd like to look at three things. Humility, confidence, and inspiration. And so I wanted to say that now so that you can just plant that seed in your mind and reflect on those things. Humility, confidence, and inspiration in relation to all that we've been studying over this ango. These 37 verses, the Bodhisattva path. What are they? How do you find them? Why are they important? When you can't find them, how do you practice them? And so we'll take that up tomorrow. So, so.
For more from the Mountains and Rivers Order, visit mountainrecord.org, where you'll find interviews, media reviews, essays, and the latest news from Zen Mountain Monastery, the Zen Center of New York City, and beyond. You'll also find a link to our new print journal, which is simply called Mountains and Rivers. The journal features articles from MRO teachers, stunning photography, and insightful conversations. The journal can be purchased from monasterystore.org. Thanks for listening.